everybody. Welcome to episode 5 of Scholarly Peers podcast. And today I have another guest with me who is my colleague at Queen's University Belfast, Dr. Mel Ingman. Thank you very much, Mel, for agreeing to speak with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for inviting me.
All right. So let's start with who you are. So can you briefly introduce yourself and especially your experience in journal peer review?
Sure. So I came to Queen's in August of 2019 as a lecturer or assistant professor in education. I'm currently serving as director of the Master's in TESOL program here. I've spent several years as strand coordinator for the Language Maintenance and Revitalization Strand at the American Association of Applied Linguistics. So that's some review experience in conference abstract reading. I'm also currently the book reviews editor for the journal Language and Education, which is published by Taylor and Francis. And as you may be able to tell from my accent, I'm from the US. Much of my academic career first took place on the other side of the Atlantic. I began my research career with a master's in applied linguistics in 2011 from University of Wisconsin, and then a PhD in second language education in 2017 from the University of Minnesota. My research is broadly concerned with questions relating to language and power, especially in educational contexts. And most of my work has been with indigenous languages such as Ojibwe Mo'in, which is indigenous to the Great Lakes region of North America, and with Gaeilge, which is indigenous to the island of Ireland here. To talk more about maybe peer review experience, the PhD programs in the US, they tend to take longer than they do here in the UK. Mine was 5 years from start to finish. And so throughout those years, I was given a lot of opportunities to review and to be reviewed by, you know, generous supervisors who encouraged my classmates and me to submit abstracts to conferences and manuscripts to journals. They would have us peer review as part of our coursework. And they would invite us to peer review for them, for the journals that they edited. And they often also co-authored with us regularly. So there was really like an apprenticeship model for me anyway, for learning about how to do peer review, how to receive it, and how to take part in it as a reviewer. And there were definitely some formative experiences during those early years. You know, the usual crushing experiences, receiving highly critical reviews, but also some more empowering experiences with providing feedback, you know, like practicing my own kind of critical reading skills and learning that I actually, you know things and I'm participating in like text creation as a reader. So I've published book chapters and articles in a variety of journals, ranging from like local practitioner journals to international journals. And that's been really helpful for understanding the peer review process as a reviewee. But I've also co-edited special issues. I've reviewed for journals across a wide range of language and language learning related disciplines. And that's been really beneficial in terms of learning about the process as a reviewer.
Okay, right. So I think it's very interesting when you mention the U.S. Doctoral programs and how you were given opportunities to navigate the journal peer review process very early and have that exposure. We may go back to that later when we talk about like professional development. That's a very interesting perspective. Let's first talk about your experience, some of the unforgettable peer review experiences you had. As an author first, and by unforgettable, I think we both can interpret it as both positively unforgettable or negatively.
Yeah. So I have a really, really good one that I want to share, one that really stands out. And it actually has to do with the journal that I'm currently the book review editor for. So when I was still, that's Language and Education. So when I was still working on my PhD, my supervisor told all of her supervisees that we needed to set this goal, like a personal goal of publishing a book review within the next year. And she, you know, told us, walked us through the genre, explained, you know, here's what a book review entails. Here's how you go about asking if you could write one for a journal. You know, you have to match the book with the journal, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I'm always a very dutiful, diligent student. So I immediately set about the task according to her, her commands. So I found a book that was published just a few months ago. I emailed the book review editor of Language and Education to ask if I could review the book for the journal. So Rita Silver was the book review editor at the time, and she's at the National Institute of Education in Singapore. And she was really kind. You know, in my email, I was careful to explain that I have a supervisor, and I told her who my supervisor was and confirmed that the supervisor had offered to oversee the review as a sort of, you know, sort of a guarantee that the review would be solid, which is a good thing to do if you're hoping to write an unsolicited book review. So Rita agreed. She had the book sent to me, and I wrote my first book review. And in my mind, I thought it was a really like creative, genre-busting synthesis of the book. But that's because I didn't really know any better. Book reviews are actually a pretty straightforward genre. A lot of people rely on book reviews to decide if they want to buy the book or read the book. So it has to be really descriptive. And book reviews maybe shouldn't be as like artistic as I tried to make it. And in hindsight, when I look back at what that first draft looked like, it was a disaster. It wasn't just like a genre bending book review. It was completely off the wall. And it maybe even made the book kind of unrecognizable to anyone who would read it. I kind of can't believe that Rita gave me a second chance, but her feedback was really generous. It was really constructive. You know, book reviews tend to be about 1500 words. She probably wrote that much in her feedback. But not only that, she actually suggested that we have a Skype call to kind of talk me through and provide further guidance. It was above and beyond what a book review editor would typically have the bandwidth for, but it was so instructive and it was so gentle and generous. And essentially the feedback was start over, you know, write it, rewrite it from top to bottom. But the feedback was exactly what I needed. And, you know, just like a few smaller revisions after that, it was published. That one stands out to me. It's unforgettable because the level of support that I received was extraordinary. But it really made all the difference, especially because I was still a PhD student. And the funny thing about that story now, actually, is that Rita Silver, who was the book review editor, she is now the editor-in-chief of the journal Language and Education. And I am now her book reviews editor. So I don't know, maybe there was some foreshadowing there. Anyway, truly unforgettable. That was some guidance that is beyond what you could ever really expect. And it was really beneficial.
I think that's a beautiful story with a very, very happy ending and obviously a very fruitful process. And I think that's another testimony to show the power of the destructive or constructive power of feedback to a doctoral student or an early career researcher. So yeah, I think that's very, very good to hear. Let's switch to your other identities now as a journal peer reviewer and now the book reviews editor of the journal. What are your experiences?
Yep. So as the book reviews editor, I try to remember the lessons that Rita modeled for me many years ago. We tend not to take too many unsolicited reviews simply because it is so time consuming to coordinate. And also I always sort of have a pipeline of trying to make sure I get through the reviews in a timely manner. And COVID has really, I think it's really kind of turned everyone's workloads upside down. So we're still kind of struggling with like what is an appropriate pipeline for book reviews. But it's been really interesting because especially if I'm reviewing book reviews, I'm essentially reviewing somebody's interpretation of another person's work. And so it requires that I kind of step back and like allow some interpretations that I may not agree with. I have to allow them to stand and to be heard because that's the reviewer's voice. And it's actually really interesting to see how ideas, you know, if I've read the book as well, to see how those ideas are interpreted by another person. And it makes me kind of, how can I put this? It kind of like restores my faith in scholarship in general, that we can read the same thing and have so many different opinions, but But it still seems to sort of contribute to like discussion rather than there's only one way to interpret someone's writing. It's been really fun to be the book reviews editor. Also, I get to see what's coming up. I get to stay current on all the publications. And that's just really fun to kind of go through the catalogs as the publishers send them out and see what's coming out. Yeah, it's quite a lot of fun. Yeah.
Right. So before we talk about maybe your experience as a peer reviewer, let's talk a little bit about the role of book reviews editor, because I think this is a role that maybe not a lot of early career researchers are very familiar with. They know there is the editor in chief, the associate editor, but there's also an editor in charge of books, book reviews. So what's your role as a book reviews editor?
Yeah, so I wasn't actually clear on this either until I took on the role myself. So the book reviews are treated separately from manuscripts that might be empirical studies or conceptual works. The book reviews are really just reviewed by me. I'm not coordinating blind peer reviews of book reviews. So that's why it's less likely to get an unsolicited book review, because I'm usually trying to match a book with a scholar in the field who is known for also doing work in that area. But so the role of the book review editor is to essentially coordinate the publication of reviews for books that are deemed of interest to the readership of the journal. So I look for books that fall within the aims and scope of the journal Language and Education. I hope to find books that are published within the last year, maybe the last 2 years, if it's a really important book or one that maybe got missed because of COVID. And then I try to find reviewers who I think have the background and the expertise to be able to speak to the book's content and its relevance to the field.
Okay, right. So how about writing a book review for a journal? Because I, as you said, maybe it's a good starting point for a doctoral student to when they want to publish, like start with a book review. But what's the process? Can you walk us through if a PhD student would like to publish a book review? What are the steps?
Yeah. So sometimes PhD students end up writing book reviews because their supervisor has been approached to write one, and the supervisor might say, I am too bogged down with work, but I have this promising PhD student who has similar expertise and can write this. And that's an ideal situation, because then the supervisor is aware that the review is being written, and the supervisor often will have some oversight over the review just to kind of guide the reviewer's work prior to their first submission of it. But if you're a PhD student and you really would like to write a book review unsolicited, it's very possible, and it is a really good activity for a PhD student to do. What you want to do is make sure, first of all, that the book you want to review is a match for the journal's aims and scope. So don't just think, oh, here's a journal that is a really big journal and would look great on my CV. I'll just pick a book that I want to read and see if I can review it. It needs to be a match. Like we've rejected some book reviews because they're simply not about the kind of topic that our readership would be coming to our journal for, even if it is really interesting. And then it is good if you can get your supervisor to agree to kind of look over your shoulder a little bit. If a PhD student writes me an email and the book is a good fit and the PhD student explains their background a little bit, so I know that they do have some experience in the field, you know, if it's a book about pedagogy and they've been practicing teachers, or their PhD is on something very similar, so I know they've been reading in that area a lot, that helps. And then if they say, by the way, my supervisor is this person with an expertise in this area as well, and they will be, they've offered to offer me guidance as I'm writing, that's really helpful, because it just means that there's an extra set of eyes guiding, and it's not all on me to make sure that I'm bringing this person, you know, sort of mentoring them into this new genre. Because that story I told about Rita Silver, like I can't do that for every student. That was so above and beyond. It was so extraordinary. So then when you're writing it, remember the point of the book review really is to describe it. They're highly descriptive, actually. Don't try to really criticize everything and make it connect to 12 different citations. It's really meant to be a description of what the book is about. So people can read it and they can decide if they should order the book for themselves or for their library. So it's mostly descriptive. It should be situated in the field a little bit, and you want to, you know, definitely interpret it a little bit. You know, you're allowed to weigh in on how you experienced the book, whether you enjoyed it, how it connected with work that you that you're working on right now, or maybe things, places where it fell short or things that it missed. You're allowed to do some of that kind of at the end, but in general, it should be mostly descriptive, especially if it's an edited volume. You want to make sure that each of the chapters is explained as well as you can anyway in under 2,000 words. It's actually quite difficult sometimes.
Okay, good. So thank you for that advice. How about your experience as a journal peer reviewer? Do you have any unforgettable experience in that identity?
Yeah, sure. So in 2019, I was invited to join two colleagues, Anne-Marie Garitas and Kathleen Graves, to co-guest edit a special issue of the Modern Language Journal. And the special issue was all on materials use in language learning and teaching. I had never, you know, I just got my PhD in 2017, so I had never done anything like that before. So I felt really lucky to be working alongside both of those women. And especially because the contributor articles were submitted for review in March of 2020, it was really good to have co-guest editors who knew what they were doing. Because, you know, if everything's submitted for review in March of 2020, that means most of our organizing and reviewing work is happening just as COVID-19 is kind of turning everyone's workloads upside down. And that was, you know, so there's the pandemic, and that's closely followed by increased civic action and protest around racial injustice and unjust policing, and especially in the US and the UK, where a lot of our authors and reviewers were located. So we had suddenly all these reviewers and authors who were experiencing illness, chaos, like truly unsustainable workloads. And the same was true for the editorial board at the Modern Language Journal. So the deadlines could only be stretched so far. And it felt like we were trying to, as peer review editors, like special guest editors, we were trying to review the reviews, but also kind of manage everyone's workload as everyone was trying to give all that they could to all of the obligations that were suddenly popping up all around them. So we found ourselves often having to choose between keeping a deadline versus having a quality review. And in every case that we had to make this call, we chose to extend the deadline. And in every case, that made all the difference. And we were unbelievably fortunate. We got really high quality reviews from our reviewers. I can remember reading through the reviews as they came in, you know, like just under the wire, and thinking, if this review isn't thorough, if it's not comprehensive, I'm going to be awake all night trying to like figure this out. I remember feeling overwhelming relief reading some of these. You know, scholars whose lives are in chaos are somehow still able to find the time to give high quality feedback that engaged with methodology and rhetoric and even like to the level of transcription conventions. It was really remarkable. And I think that goes to show that once, if you can get into the practice of reviewing regularly, maybe it's not quite as time consuming as if you only do a few a year. Like if you can do at least one a month, it actually maybe takes less bandwidth because you're more practiced with it.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's also something very interesting about your experience, Mel, as a special issue editor. And that's something maybe not a lot of our audience are aware of what that role is. And you kind of talked a little bit about it, that it's like an editor that you will oversee the whole process of peer review, and there are other reviewers that you invite to review the submissions. If an early career researcher or doctoral student is thinking about submitting to a special issue, not editing one, but maybe submitting to a special issue, is it something that they can consider, or are editors of special issue very, very selective in the kind of authors and contributors? Because I have heard different opinions. Some people say it's easier because they need to have certain number of submissions to ensure 5, 6, 7 articles. So it's easier, and they won't always say no and reject you because they need to find another article to replace you. But other people have said it's harder because they may have people in mind that could represent. So from your experience, what's your advice?
I think it really depends, and it's not really helpful, but it depends on what the special issue is and who the special issue editors are. Because sometimes people may have certain scholars in mind, or they may sometimes special issues that arise out of like a conference symposium or something. There's already contributors who are set because this is something that's already sort of been growing from another collaborative effort. But I've also contributed to special issues where there was just a call and we just kind of responded with an abstract and it got accepted. And so I think you're better off if you see a call, absolutely. If the call is a fit, they wouldn't put a call out if they already had all of the contributors lined up. So if you see a call, and especially if they're only asking for an abstract, definitely go for it. Submit, you know, it. They wouldn't be asking if they didn't need it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. So let's talk about going back to your own experience and what you talked about earlier about your PhD experience. So how do you learn to navigate this peer review process? You talked a little bit about the experiences that you had during your PhD. Can you share with us a little bit more?
Sure. I mean, first I want to say I am still learning. This is something I will never feel like, oh, I know it now. And I see you smiling and nodding because I think maybe you feel the same way. I'm still learning. So every review I do, every review I receive is contributing to helping me understand the process. But yes, going back to PhD programs, I credit my supervisors, Kendall King and Mary Hermes at the University of Minnesota, for pushing me to practice giving feedback, practice receiving feedback from an early stage in my career. Peer feedback was really a part of that PhD program that I was in. It was part of classes. We were often asked to comment on each other's work. It was part of any sort of, you know, pilot studies or any small scale research endeavors that we took up before we began our dissertation research. And if you think about it, that's actually really, I think it's really good practice, because the kind of feedback that you give to a classmate and friend, you know, somebody you see every day, somebody you're often vulnerable with in like challenging academic situations, the feedback that you would give to them might be different from the feedback that you would give to an anonymous stranger. Mm-hmm. It forces you to kind of take care to highlight strengths alongside the criticisms. And when you make criticisms, you have to provide rationales for those criticisms. I think that's really useful, because if you start early doing that, so this wouldn't be blind peer review. This is, your name's on it. And so you have to remember that these are human beings you're giving feedback to. And I think it has actually really shaped the kind of feedback I give now to people who I don't know when I'm doing blind peer review. Mm-hmm. And in terms of navigating the process, I think it's been really helpful to remember just generally that reviewers and editors are just people. You know, when reviews come back that are unclear or perhaps even unfair, it's okay to ask questions. You can email editors for clarification if you get a review that doesn't make sense to you. And if needed, you can ask for additional time to think about the feedback, to craft an appropriate response. It's, you know, you can push back on reviewer comments sometimes if you think the reviewer has missed your point, or maybe they're misguided, because they're just human beings. You know, I think we talk about peer review, they're peers, but we still talk about it like it's this hierarchical thing. But really, don't be afraid to remember that it's meant to be dialogical, and you should treat it that way. The point of it is that we're all imperfect, so we rely on our peers to strengthen our work. And I think sometimes, because of the gatekeeping that peer reviews tend to do, it becomes this hierarchical thing, but it really shouldn't be. And so don't be afraid to ask questions, to push back, to ask for clarification. I think that would actually benefit the process.
Okay. Yeah, I really like what you said. When people think about peer review feedback, they maybe think about something very technical, very academic, but it's basically about kindness and respect and, you know, something as basic as everyday communication. So I think that's very good to remind us of. So how about some challenges that you have faced maybe before in the, or maybe even now in the peer review process?
Yeah. So I don't have like a heartwarming story or anecdote or anything to go with like the challenges. I mean, so really for me, the biggest challenge is one half emotional and one half temporal. And I just peer review is still always kind of a struggle in terms of receiving it, because no matter how much I prepare mentally for reviewer responses, I still feel those deep cuts anytime I read criticism. And I know it's coming. That's part of the process. And it's still, it feels kind of bad every time. But I also recognize the reviews really do make the manuscript stronger. I know I need to get over that emotional hump of reading through the comments before I can get to work. And so sometimes I have to block off a little bit of time to just say like, okay, I'm going to read through the comments. I won't work on them. I'll just read through them, digest them. So that's why it's actually really nice to work with somebody, because you can process those comments together. But then the temporal half, it's really time consuming. You spend so much time working on a manuscript and you submit it, and then it's sort of, it's like, whew, done. It's off my plate. You feel like you have time back. And so then when the reviews come back and you need to revise, expect to spend more time. And I never can quite schedule the time to do the revisions in a way that I would like to. It seems like the reviews seem to come back at times that are always inconvenient, when I'm always kind of overloaded. But again, this is where co-authoring is so beneficial. Not only does co-authoring help you sort of deal with the emotional blow of criticisms, but also it can soften the workload when you can kind of distribute it across more than one person.
Okay, right. So let's talk about support for early career researchers and doctoral students. What do you think can be done in this regard, in terms of preparing them for the peer review process?
Yeah, so I would say the most important thing would be practicing. So you want to give, so early career researchers and doctoral students need more opportunities to practice giving feedback first. I think that will really inform the work that they end up producing for submission later on, if they're able to think like a reviewer when they're writing. So for early career researchers, that might mean that they should be incorporated into review processes for journals and conferences and books, even if they have limited or no experience with some of those writing genres. You know, I don't think you need to have written a book to be able to review it. And I think that PhD students and early career, especially early career researchers, because they have done independent research at this point, I think they would actually be really excellent reviewers for journal articles, for manuscripts, and for books. And I think that they should be incorporated more. That's more like a call to editors to bring in more early career researchers. And then for graduate students, I think a lot of support comes down to supervisors. We owe it as supervisors. We owe it to our graduate students to co-author abstracts and papers, or maybe book chapters with them, so that their introduction to the peer review can be kind of accompanied. You know, we can apprentice them into it by doing it with them the first time.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned in the supervision process and PhD program, it's really up to the individual supervisors to provide opportunities for their students. Do you think something more structural in terms of being an integral part of the PhD program would be helpful, or you think it's more about the kind of incidental encounters that would help the PhD students more?
Yeah, so I would say it should be something maybe that's more integral to the PhD program. When students are pursuing a PhD, they're pursuing a research degree. We should assume that they intend to do research and be researchers. So I don't know what that would look like. It would depend on different universities. But if there are universities that have opportunities for those built in, either through like student organizations that maybe organize conferences, or through coursework, you know, if that can be a part of the classes that students are taking, part of their training. I think it actually should be a part of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Now, to conclude our episode today, if you were to give a piece of advice to doctoral students and early career researchers who are going to submit their first ever manuscript to a journal, maybe they're hesitating now, self-doubting themselves, what's the advice you would give them?
We'll say it's in three steps. Step one, just double check the journal's aims and scope and make sure that your piece is appropriate for it. Okay. And you may want to read articles the journal's published to make sure that, yes, you're kind of like where their sweet spot is. But then before you submit, have a colleague read it for you. This is something that academics do all the time. When we have a manuscript, we're ready to submit. Before we hit submit, we send it to a couple of critical friends who we know will be honest with us. Maybe not 100% honest, but they'll be able to look for, you could have them read for specific things, you know, like if it's an empirical article, have them read with an eye for methods or analysis. Make sure those findings are crystal clear. Or if it's a conceptual article, ask your friends to just read with a focus on theory. Have them highlight any instances of ambiguity or places where they wanted more example or citation. But, you know, if you don't necessarily want to ask your friend for like global comments, you could have them focus on one or two things. But you always want someone to read it not blind before you submit it. I think that catches a lot of things that can actually really distract the reviewers from what you want the blind peer reviewers to be doing. And then like the last piece of advice is just submit, go for it. You know, like worst case scenario, you get a desk rejection and then you can submit it somewhere else. You know, like it, everyone gets rejected. It's a part of it. And I know I said it, I'm still like, my biggest challenge is still dealing with that, the emotions of rejection, but I've got to get used to it because that's a part of this. Peer review means we're asking people to take a look at what we're doing, and you can't make something that everybody likes. So if you get a rejection, that's fine. That's still feedback, and you can take it somewhere else and still grow from it. Submit it. Give it a try.
Okay, thank you very much. I really like your last piece of advice. You know, even it's criticism towards the work, but not the person, not who you really are. So yeah, thank you very much, Mel, for speaking with us today, sharing your experiences. Thank you so much.
No, you're welcome. It was my pleasure. Thanks, Inwan. See ya.